Hi, and welcome to this week's VFX show. I'm Mike Seymour, back from not-so-sunny, incredibly snowed-in London, joined on the line by my good friend John Flowers. How are you, John?
I'm fantastic.
And John's good friend, also mine, Mark Christensen. How are you, Mark?
Hey, fun.
Hey, so this is like putting the band back together, guys, getting the three of us on. It's good fun to be here, and we're looking at Valkyrie. Mark, have you... did you know of the sort of nature of the Klaus von Stauffenberg story before you saw the film?
You know, I might have known a bit about it. I certainly knew that there were these many attempts on Hitler's life and that the last one came the closest and that it had something to do with the Wolf's Lair. But I certainly didn't know as much as I know now.
And John, you're an educated man. Were you up with the story prior to seeing the film?
I was like Mark, generally familiar with it, but like Mark, I wasn't completely familiar with it. As he said, there were, you know, something like a total of 16 attempts over 10 months, the last 10 months there of his life. So,
yeah, way to feel popular.
Yeah.
So I've got to tell you right off the bat, I'm going to jump in and say I loved this film. Not only did I love it, but I was stunned at how much I was sitting on the edge of my seat saying, oh my God, what's going to happen? And then I said, to myself in the theater, well, hang on a second. I know what happens. Hitler doesn't die. But it was good that, because I'm not, you know, ever since Cruise jumped the couch, I'm not, you know, a Cruise fan per se. But yeah, I've got to say, I liked the film. I thought it was really thrilling. And especially as I knew what was coming, I can't believe how sort of tense it made me. But what about you, John? What did you think?
I thought it was pretty great. I mean, I'm a big fan, like who isn't, right, of Bryan Singer. And I think Christopher McQuarrie is just an excellent writer. He was also one of the producers of this. He was also the writer of Usual Suspects, Way of the Gun, which if you haven't seen it is quite good. So, yeah, I thought it was fantastic. I thought it had the appropriate amount of speed and tenacity to tell the story that it was trying to tell. I was also really excited to see that they didn't go into the kind of usual or traditional crazy place where it's all, you know, guns, bombs, and steel, like a lot of these, you know, typical war movies. I mean, this was a thinking person's war movie, if you will.
Yeah, it's an interesting point you bring up there because Bryan Singer himself said that you can either think of Bryan Singer's films in terms of the sort of Superman Returns blockbusters or the Usual Suspects kind of thing. And to a certain extent, Tom Cruise as well, you know, Born on the 4th of July versus, you know, the more obvious films. And there are some Tom Cruise films I love. So Minority Report is one of them. But Mark, what about you? Would you join us in praising the film as a film?
Well, I always have a slight wave of dread when the opening credits include a card that says this is based on a true story, because I'm concerned when I see that the film will be slavishly true to the facts and potentially miss the metaphorical truth, maybe the larger truth of the film, because, of course, they'll slavishly try to get every detail right. And then people who are actually there will see it and say, well, but yeah, but it wasn't really that or whatever. Having said that, I'm right with you, Mike. I couldn't agree more that it was just a gripping, lavishly made film, beautiful to look at. I was really happy to see it on a big screen. And it really had me right up until the bomb went off in the little room outside the lair, and the thing failed. And then that is when I actually wanted this movie to go to some other level. And it didn't. And so that's when the problem that you cite, for me, actually caught up. I was happy to suspend disbelief right up until about then, maybe a little further after, about the fact that I already knew that they weren't going to succeed. But in the end, the guy's story didn't lift off. So it's like, you know, the images that you're left with, and when I'm saying metaphorical, it's like, who is this guy as a figure? And from the film, most of the things we got about him are that, you know, he would miss his wife and that he believed in Germany. But I think it actually closed in for the last third or half of the film. And so I was much more taken in by it for the first part of it.
I will say that, I sort of know what you're saying there. I do think that it was a good pacing. There are some films, obviously, like Titanic, where you absolutely know the ending and you don't care. There are other films like well, I won't sort of pick on things. I want to be positive this week. But there are other films where you know what the ending is, and really, quite frankly, you just want to get there because, you know, it's just everything else seems like a lead up to it. I thought this was interesting and, I guess, to a certain extent, important because it portrayed a large number, or a significant number, I should say, of Germans as not actually being Nazis and not necessarily supporting all of the Nazi agenda. And I think that's important because, you know, obviously for kids today, it's easy just to think of all Germans as being Nazis. And in fact, that wasn't the case. And that's a pretty long shadow that's cast across an entire population. I do
Although it did do the classic old, even, you know, during the war era, the classic thing they would do, which is to have the good guys all have British accents and the bad Germans all actually speak German.
I was going to ask you about that, actually, because it was it's an eternal problem in films, isn't it, when you've got a foreign language thing. I think one of the most interesting attempts to solve that was the Russian thriller with Sean Connery on the sub called, I've forgotten briefly.
You know, Hunt for Red October.
Thank you. Where they actually had them speaking Russian, and then the camera panned in on their mouths, and it moved to English, and then it kept on going after that. John, what was your take on the obviously American and British accent on our lead actors?
I think it's hilarious. I think we see that in all kinds of different ways. I'm reminded of the first season of 24, where all the bad guys, you knew they were bad because they were running Dell computers or PCs, and you knew all the guys who were good were running Macs. And I just, you know, it was such an almost, you know, overt and, you know, in a way, offensive way to just go, oh, well, you know, all the good guys have this trait and all the bad guys have this other trait. And, you know, if you can't figure that out, you haven't seen enough TV or movies. And I kind of felt a little bit like, you know, with this show, I mean, the saving grace to me with Valkyrie, though, is that there were so many people in it that it was nice to have a little bit of a differentiation just so you could keep track of them all. I mean, what are there, you know, 35 characters or 35 people in the, you know, in the basically the main and supporting cast for this film?
Yeah, I must admit, I thought it was great that Bill Knightley's character and even Tom Wilkinson's characters weren't painted as just black and just white. Obviously, you know, we ended up siding with them or against them, but quite frankly, there were a number of characters that... Eddie Izzard, that kind of surprised me, their performances. I thought they were really good. I didn't expect to like them as much in the role they did. And they weren't completely black or completely white. They weren't, you know, all the goodies were all good all the time. Did that resonate with you at all, Mark? Or did you find it was very black and white on who was good and who was bad?
I don't think it was completely black and white. It definitely humanized a bunch of German generals. They all seemed slightly insecure.
Yeah, I mean, Kenneth Branagh, I thought, was a cracker. I mean, just loved his, especially the ending, of course, when he takes his own life. It was, I thought it was quite moving. But I guess we should swing around to visual effects for a second and discuss this in terms of visual effects, because that's what we're here for. And this was a picture that was primarily made by Sony Picture Image Works, who do outstanding work. We know them to do very good work. We had a story on FX Guide about it, where we interviewed Rich Hoover from SPI. But I think the thing about Sony's work is that they themselves admitted that this was not a film where they were developing brand new technology. This was not like a Spider-Man where they're trying to break the mold in terms of technology. It was more applying the techniques that they had very, very effectively, built on the previous work done by Third Floor. So starting with you, John, do you want to give us your overall impression of the visual effects in this film?
Well, I think they served the story perfectly because I didn't really notice when they were there. And I think that's a good thing. I mean, I can tell you that I did, to myself, while I was watching it, there were many, many times where I did think to myself, my God, how much roto work did they have to do in this film? Yeah. Because of, you know, Tom Cruise's hand missing and then the two fingers missing. I happen to know they did a tremendous amount of roto work and a tremendous amount of tracking to just do all of that. But, you know, that was something I was consciously aware of because the one thing you noticed is Tom Cruise runs around and he doesn't have that strange sort of one sleeve slightly longer than the other, or, you know,
that bizarre
way that people hide their arms when they're trying to hide. So, yeah, none of that. I mean, so they did just a phenomenal job in this film of making me believe absolutely this guy has a, you know, missing hand.
Yeah, I thought it was really good. For those of you that don't know the technique, let's jump right in on that because I like getting geeky. Mark, do you know or do you want me to discuss how they did the fingers?
Yeah, I do know a bit about it. I know that they really did not want to use green screen for this or green glove because of the reflectivity problem. And obviously the hand's often going to be in shadow. That's kind of a nightmare. It just really, I think, would, I mean, I can say myself, I wouldn't want to have to deal with that. So I think they made a really smart move, which was to use makeup on the hand and just draw lines on Tom Cruise's hands, right where they're supposed to be cut off, to give a hint where the roto, you know, clip roto here, kind of a hint. And then they had a lot of roto. That's what I picked up. Is there more to it?
No, I think that's exactly right. Though, John, you're aware of the actual, you know, once they had those finger markings for the point at which the joints would come off to keep consistency between shots, the actual digit removal was quite complex, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. I mean, they actually built a full version, a full 3D version of his hand in Maya. And then every single movement that he made, they, as you said, they had these marks on his hand. They tracked it using Buju. I believe that's how you pronounce that.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And then literally like frame by frame. So every single frame Tom Cruise is in where he's walking around and you have, you know, even a medium shot of him is a frame by frame track using Buju. And then there's hand replacement or the absence of a hand replacement in every single shot everywhere he goes. So it's just a tremendous amount of number crunching using both Maya and Buju.
Yeah. And I think it does work. I mean, as you say, that in just incidental shots, you'd not sort of got that horrible feeling of the they did actually try prosthetics putting on, you know, sort of things, but it just didn't work. It had all those problems that we don't like of making it look like your arm is absurdly long and or your shoulder is being deliberately pulled back in the socket to try and make it look shorter. So I thought it was a very successful technique, and, you know, full marks to Retriever and the team for just, you know, biting the bullet and actually solving that by hand. But as I said, probably more of a dedicated team approach to just plowing through it than any kind of revolutionary new technological solution, as in fact was, you know, the case with much of the historical thing. Because let's face it, not only were they worried about Tom Cruise's digits and hand removal, and didn't you guys love the Führer salute, Mark? I mean, you know, where he salutes with the...
That's a good moment. Yeah, that's a good way for him to undercut his... apparently, Stauffenberg was not even a Nazi Party member, and he's asked to salute the Führer, so he does it with his missing arm. It's got all the correct symbolism.
Which was, by the way, that was done. Did you hear that was done using Maxon's body paint? That whole hand was...
I did not know that.
Textured using Maxon body paint, which I think this may be one of the first times we've seen something at that level using that tool.
Hmm. Yeah, that's really interesting. I was going to say also that, of course, in addition to Tom Cruise's character, there was a lot of historical stuff because, you know, any period drama has that. And these guys were lucky in that they were allowed to get to many of the actual buildings that were relevant, because a lot of these buildings, perhaps rebuilt, are still standing in Germany. And so they were filming in these areas, but of course they had to do a lot of set extension, removal of modern stuff, in some cases, such as the church where the roof wasn't on, they had to, you know, basically do extensions of visual effects stuff. And I thought all those 2.5D extensions and 2D mapping work that was digitally done worked really well, because it did feel at no point to me like we were shooting on a soundstage where, you know, all the streets turned the corner and it was very restricted. It didn't feel like it was constrained. It felt like it was outdoors, it was at the locations, and it had a kind of healthy establishing shot, you know, breath of fresh air when we got to the various locations around Germany. Do you feel that, Mark?
Yeah, I wanted to say it. I think the shot in question with the church with the big hole in it and the starry sky behind it is really one of the most inspired shots in the film. So not, you know, particularly technically difficult, but just a really nice thing to do to, you know, I don't know, just show something that
nice one to really, have on your showreel. Yeah, it was a really nice, yeah, moment.
Yeah, it really placed the film in that era, and I don't know, it lifted somehow around that shot.
But based apparently on a true story, that's actually what happened.
Yeah, and actually another aside, I did want to throw in on Maxon's behalf that they're trumpeting the use of Cinema 4D on Dark Knight as well at Framestore. So it's been a good year for cinema, I guess.
And John, were you comfortable with the matte paintings and the 2.5D extensions? Because I thought they worked really well.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I'll tell you, actually, one of the most impressive shots in the whole film, to me, to my eye, was the Berghof, which is the residence that Hitler had in, I guess, Bavaria.
Mm-hmm.
There was actually a ski resort in Austria where people were skiing, right? And they had this beautiful shot of this ski resort, and they went in and they actually built, through the use of matte paintings and obviously some 3D work, they built that Bavarian residence of his, the Berghof, right there on the side of the mountain. And that shot to me, just, I couldn't tell. I saw it. I knew it wasn't real. And there wasn't a moment in it where I thought, that's not a real house. That's not a real place. But apparently none of it is.
Yeah, it's really good too, because it's actually kind of familiar. Some of the shots in this film, you know, exist on newsreels and so on, especially, I mean, that location, I think of it as somewhat iconic.
Definitely.
You know, along with the shots of Hitler with his dog. They really, those resounded quite well, I agree.
We haven't discussed the initial scenes with the Panzer divisions in North Africa. So let's swing around to those now. And I want to give the filmmakers credit, because I felt this was, in many respects, even though they're obviously using high-tech tools, just a really good old-fashioned film, in that where they could, such as in that North African stuff, they were using real planes. You know, when they could, they used the real locations and then did extensions to them. So I sort of thought that the whole thing had a lot of authenticity. That opening Panzer attack, where the Allied forces obviously caused the injuries to Tom Cruise's Klaus von Stauffenberg's character, was initially a much, much longer scene, and Third Floor did a lot of previous work on that I actually managed to see. But as it sat in the film, I thought it worked really, really well, and I thought that it just, you know, hit the right beats, and we didn't get too self-indulgent with, you know, bomb cam or anything else like that. It just felt pretty honest and upfront. What about you, John?
Oh, I thought it was great. I think it's especially impressive when you think about, you know, these P-40 airplanes that you're having to have overhead. I mean, clearly these, you know, they don't exist really anymore, and they certainly don't exist in any kind of real way. So they had footage of just one or two of those. And then they, you know, created these CG planes, you know, by cloning the, the real ones, and then compositing them into the background. And I mean, you think about like every single muzzle flash, every single shot, every single piece of that scene, all of it, with maybe just a few exceptions, is all digital. And so that whole scene felt very real. It reminded me of Children of Men. You know, that scene in Children of Men where he's running around and you swear that scene is, you know, they're actually setting off a lot of explosions and stuff. But so much of that was CG or composited.
Yeah, it worked for me. What about you, Mark?
Yeah, definitely. It had a visceral punch to it. The sound really supported the visuals in that sequence as well.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it was good filmmaking. I think it was, you know, it did what it needed to do, and it didn't hang around too long, and it certainly didn't get self-indulgent, because it is really easy with, you know, explosions and stuff to go, this would be a cool shot and that'd be a cool shot and wouldn't this be funky. And his disorientation in the Jeep leading up to the last shot, I thought, you know, just played out really well.
Absolutely. And they did the thing that you talk about not being self-indulgent. They did the thing that is really hard to pull off, but when you do pull it off, it works perfectly, which is they, rather than turn the volume to 11 and have the explosions just rumble and rock the theater, when that first bomb went off, they dropped the volume by about 50%, maybe even more. And so you have this kind of muted, you know, explosions in the background. Like, it's just surreal. But, you know, the way that it would be if you were there, because you would lose some portion of your hearing. And I think a lot of films don't pull that off well.
Right. It gives you that sense of how people remember an event and it gives it that, like, you know it's going to be bad.
I think they did that on Saving Private Ryan, didn't they? On the Normandy Beach landings?
Yeah, I think so.
And I think it is, you're right, it's used to great effect. The absence of sound is so disorientating in that environment, and you just feel like that's what it would be like. I've never been.
Well, it's similar to how you remember a car crash, and it gives it, without actually having to go into slow motion for the whole thing, it gives that same frozen deer in the headlights feeling, I think.
I mean, it would have been possible to just do digital P40s and to not get Messerschmitts and to not, you know, go to the trouble of having real tanks and stuff and done it a lot more digitally, but I think it just benefited from not doing that. Everything was so grounded that when they did go to the digital versions, you didn't really sort of have, you didn't have the shot that flew around a plane that said this is digital because there's no way I could pull this off. The cinematography of the digital work really matched the cinematography that you would do for real, and I think that benefited the film. And I just keep on coming out to this idea that it's kind of an old-fashioned good film in terms of good filmmaking. I'm not talking just in terms of the plot now, but just, you know, got some actors, you've got a good sort of thriller going, you try and make it properly, you don't try and do it all, you know, to break the rules of filmmaking, and as a result you end up with a good, sensible, kind of enjoyable film that I think has found an audience pretty much. Would you agree?
Yeah, I don't know. Actually don't know anything about what the numbers were on this film, but I'm sure that it has. I mean, I think it's about to leave here, and there were still quite a number of people in the theater who certainly seemed to enjoy it.
I was in London last week, and it was heavily posted around with billboards and stuff. I think it had opened at the end of January in London, and it was certainly, you know, finding good business and finding an audience. I mean, this is an interesting time of year for films to come out, but I think it was good. When did you see it, John?
I saw it about 4 hours ago.
So you can give us a take on what it was like at the, because it must have been fairly long in its run in America. Was anyone in the cinema?
Actually, you know what? I had the most interesting experience I've had in a long time today. I go into a theater and they play the advertisements that they have. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I always try and get into a theater late because I don't want to watch the really lame leading up to movie trailers that they do here in the States. I don't know if they have this in Australia, but here in the States we have about 22 minutes of crap, only the last 4 or 5 minutes of which is, you know, a trailer you actually might want to see. so they have these trailers and then they play most of the trailers again, right? So I thought I ducked out and got to a place where I wouldn't see them all, but they started playing them again. And then they started showing a movie, and the movie they started showing was, we all saw the first 5 minutes of Underworld Rise of the Lycanthrope, or whatever the hell it's called, until they realized that they were showing the wrong movie. Then they stopped the movie, played the same set of trailers again.
Oh, no.
While they changed the reel, and then they started Valkyrie. And there were, I think, in the theater I was at, which was at downtown at the Metreon, which is quite a large, you know, movie house, there were maybe 10 people in a theater that would have sat 200, 250.
Well, yeah, but on a weekday afternoon, to be fair. I mean, I was just there last night, and, you know, that was more like there were 3 dozen people. This thing,
what are you saying, Mark? Are you saying at 1:40 in the afternoon on a Thursday that things are not well attended?
Loser.
It is San Francisco, so you never know.
There was a lot of people in the cinema when I saw it because it was opening day in Sydney. And it's done about $81 million in the US box office, which is, you know, I don't imagine this film cost a fortune to make.
They're saying 75, but I mean, yeah, come on. Give me
but
a break.
It was released, actually at the end of last year, like in America, like it was, you know. So it's been playing through January. So that's a long run. It didn't open big and then go off in one weekend. So that's really interesting. So if you haven't seen it, I totally suggest when it comes out on DVD that you get a look at it. I think it's safe to say this doesn't come off as an overly Tom Cruise picture. Obviously, he's very central to it. Obviously, it's his point of view on the story, but it's not a star vehicle, I didn't feel.
Well, although I was disappointed. I mean, I was really watching to see if they, because we've talked about his hand, but the guy's also missing an eye.
Yeah.
And there are scenes in which he's meant to have his glass eye. And I was really watching it. Like, are we really going to see a glass eye? And I only saw about two shots that really apparently had the low glamour glass eye in it. I had a bunch of them that looked like punts and probably on behalf of the star, if I'm guessing right. Not that they weren't able to pull it off, but...
Yeah, they could have done something really simple, though. They're already using Buju and tracking the crap out of stuff. They could have just tracked and put a semi-opaque, you know.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I don't think it's because they
something over it.
I think it's that their high-priced actor probably didn't want more than a smattering of shots where he would look like that.
Okay, but in the career cycle of Cruise, this isn't one of those films that you kind of go... I didn't anyway, like bloody hell, like, you know, this is just completely a star thing for him and this has just been completely bent.
No, I'll absolutely give you that. Actually, I would say I'm not a big Tom Cruise fan, but I would say that this is a charismatic guy that this film is about. And I'd say he lives up to being like the guy you would watch in the room. Like there's a bunch of, you know, old generals and then there's this dude and he definitely stands out.
Absolutely.
So
I have an interesting thing too. I don't know if you guys know this, but do you know that there were several dozen scenes that had to be reshot because in the development process, the studio, and I haven't yet been able to figure out what studio or what development studio did this, you know, but they used the wrong chemical during development and destroyed the original film. So
really?
They had to reshoot a bunch, like dozens of scenes. Yeah.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
That's like unprecedented. You've done some good research there, John.
Well, thank you.
We should have you on more often. well, look, in summing up, I think that the visual effects, as somebody, I think you said, John, served the story very well. I think that there's nothing, like if I was to be negative, I couldn't really sort of say to you, oh, there was a shot here that I just hated. Was there any shots that you guys just went, ah, what the hell's going on there?
No, I mean, really, no.
I think so. I think it was like a really, really, really competent film. Like it wasn't, John, you know,
Dave? Oh, yeah. No, I thought it was fantastic. You know, my kind of pacing, my kind of story, I loved it. Like, say, a thinking person's movie, I'm into that.
Yeah.
But what I really, the one scene I didn't care for, and I can't remember what building they were going into, but there was a scene where the camera pans up and has that kind of view from the sky, and they're going into this building, and there are literally 50 poles with these, you know, Nazi swastika flags on them. And I just thought, this is a little heavy-handed.
Well, do you or do you think that was another shot you mean? Because for me, that was more like, I mean, it was more a comment on Nazi Germany and the Nazi kind of propaganda machine than it was
on. John, that could have been documentary heavy-handedness we are talking about.
The only shot that took me out of the film, and I didn't even mind it, but I just couldn't get my head around not pondering how they did it, was when they went into the record playing Ride of the Valkyries and, you know, we had the spinning camera finally catching up with the spinning record. And I didn't mind that because obviously it was what it was, but it was by the only time that I was like, whoa, somebody had a bit of fun with that shot. did it bother you or did you?
Yeah, now that you mention it, but
It wasn't like I hated it. I was just like, it was one of the only times that I was sort of conscious of the filmmaking side of their filmmaking.
It was such a long shot, too. I mean, I was expecting it to do something else, but instead there it went and it spun to a stop so we could read the label really clearly.
Yeah. I could have lived without that shot. I didn't, you know, I mean, I kind of got what the music was as soon as I heard it in the first time they played it. So
used appropriately, perhaps, for the first time in a film. Who knows?
Yeah. That's true. Cue helicopters.
Not used for helicopters bombing a jungle.
Well, now, in Apocalypse Now, when they did it the first time, it was a classic. Now a cliche.
Yeah, no, my God. I'm certainly taking nothing away from that, but that film almost stole that music away from
I didn't
from
think I could see that.
Content.
You're absolutely right. You've totally... I couldn't imagine that I would ever hear that music and not be, you know, I love the smell of napalm in the morning.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I think we'll wrap it up there. That's definitely a film that I'd recommend if you haven't seen it. It's full marks to Sony for doing what I think a effects house should do, which is serve the story, do some really good effects, and it isn't all about just breaking the mold and inventing new things for their own sake. This was just really good use of visual effects to make a classic period drama and make a darn good film. And I'm, you know, I think we're all in agreement on that. I don't think that maybe, you know, an artist, this isn't the sort of film that you'd see as an effects film per se, or as a high profile thing, but boy, did the artists serve the story well. So congratulations to those that worked on it. John, do you want to give us an idea both where people can find you and what you're up to, and also maybe thank our producing staff?
Sure. I'll be brief with where people can find me. If you go to lifezero.org, you can find my blog. Many of you know that I'm the professor of an avid class at FX PhD, and that's going gangbusters. I'm really enjoying that. We're having a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's great.
Thank you. As far as the producers, I'd like to thank Kristen Martin, who works tirelessly to edit the glub glub garble that we tend to hand her sometimes. And I'd like to thank Laurie Apthorpe, who does a lot of great research. In the past, also Kevin Hansen has done some fantastic research.
And Mark, where can people find you? What are you up to?
Well, you know, doggone it, I am also in on a class at your fine establishment, FX PhD, Mike, and just a couple classes now in this term. But that's like 9 or 10 terms there with you guys, which is
we like
awesome.
You.
I like FX PhD a lot. And there are a lot of great classes on. Not to get too nepotistic about it, but I've really actually been enjoying a lot of the classes this term, and I'm happy that I'm not so busy teaching my own that I can't spend some time with them. Other than that, Flow Seeker on Twitter, and, you know, I'm just going to plant a stake. I've done this before on a podcast. I'm going to do it again. I'm going to resuscitate my blog a little bit. So that's also flowseeker.com, so on Twitter or the .com.
Yeah, I have
so
to
by
say,
the time this airs, there should be something there.
I have to say, I was just in London shooting, and I'll be going back again in a couple of weeks, and I have just been having a ball. That stuff for next term on PhD. But you can find me over at FX Guide, where, in fact, that story is on Valkyrie, where which I've been referring to, and some of the pictures showing you those markings on the fingers that we spoke about. I want to thank everybody for listening, and we'll had a skip to last week. We're trying to get every week, but sometimes it's every fortnight. But stick with us, and we'll put up the schedule if you want to check it out over at thevfxshow.com. Until next time, I'm Mike Seymour. See you guys.